Hello, listeners, and thanks for tuning in to another episode of World Forge. World Forge is a podcast by creators and for creators, where we use random prompts to invent just about anything you can imagine. Together, we'll make heroes and villains, ancient monsters and magical cities. And our hope is that we inspire all the other creators and storytellers out there listening to do the same. So, without any further ado, I'm Sam.
And I'm Piper.
And welcome to World Forge.
Listeners, we're back again. It's Piper and Sam, your favorite World Forge hosts.
Hey, welcome back to another episode of World Forge, you guys. We're happy to be back here. We're happy to have you back here with us.
Yeah, thanks for that. Yeah. Appreciate you taking the time.
And we're... Oh my God, what is that,
Piper? Oh my God, that freaking bird.
This bird flew back into the studio. It's
Jesus,
so weird.
Get out of here, bird.
We're recording from our World Forge Ark this week, surrounded by all kinds of... Two of every animal. There's there's another one. That's a majestic yak that's just in the other room here that keeps making noise and interrupting us while we're trying to record.
Our sweet boy yak. Yeah, Zach the yak.
Zach the yak. We're actually going to be talking about all kinds of fun animals that we're just... It's like we're Dr. Doolittle's here this week. We're talking about all kinds of fun magical and non-magical animals.
Absolutely. Man, if I can just like push these cute little geese away from my feet, they keep pecking at my toes. Well, maybe I could focus.
Like an Untitled Goose podcast is what this is this week. But yes, Piper, we're talking about all kinds of animals this week.
We are.
With some specific kind of considerations.
Exactly. Because when you're formulating your D&D adventures and you're out in the wild, it's very likely you're going to encounter some kind of animal creature. And hopefully it's one that doesn't just seem like you stitched a buffalo to a crow and it has a bit more thought behind it and the environment it comes from.
Totally. And that's what we're going to be talking about this week, is we're going to be basically assigning ourselves random biomes and then building creatures that it kind of makes sense would live in that world. So you are not just bound to the, you know, everyday wolves and deer and bears and things like that. You can have some kind of unique things to fill your world with. And we'll sort of talk about our thought process on, you know, how to establish traits that we think make a lot of sense based on the place where a creature lives and, you know, how magical of a location it is. And if there are other people that are there, you know, whatever.
Absolutely. This is actually, so I've kind of talked about this before, about one of my favorite things about world building is I want everything to make some sense. Mm-hmm. I don't want it to just be a random thing because that's quote unquote cool or whatever. Mm-hmm. I want to say, okay, if you have this wondrous thing, why does it exist? Why did it evolve this way?
Yeah.
And hence why I thought it would be really fun if we first created an environment and then say, what is something that could, that would become itself from the environment it lives in.
Completely.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's kind of our thought process behind this.
Yeah.
Are we talking about fan recommendations first?
Yeah. So we went out on Twitter and we said, hey, we're recording an episode about, you know, a whole crazy menagerie of weird animals and stuff. What do you guys do when you see a random animal out in the wild? And so we put a little poll out on Twitter, just kind of asking for your party's go-to responses for, you know, what happens when you see something. And for the most part, our listeners said they choose to befriend an animal, but there was not an insignificant amount of people that said, well, they probably have treasure. Let's kill it, right? So, you know, that may factor into some of our creations. You know, we'll be making friendly creatures. We may be making hostile creatures and we'd be making neutral creatures.
That really depends.
Yeah, there's a lot of options.
I feel like before we move on, we have to first talk about from our longest running campaign and our good friend Adam, who played a lizard man named Bridgley.
Yeah.
And his affinity to befriending every beast that he met. And it was so fun.
No matter how hostile.
Well, exactly. There was literally a session we played in which he was like trapped in the jaws of an alligator mid death roll, barrel roll in the water, and he's still like, we're like, what do you do, Adam? Yeah. He's like, I give it a snack, like, I try to make it my friend.
We're like, yeah, you want us to save you? And he's like, no, dude, no, I'm fine, it's totally cool, I think I still got this. And we're like, you dude, like your arms down his throat. He's like, no, we can still make this work.
Like, it's fine, so it's cool. Excited. I'm wearing him down. Yeah, it was
he
great.
Was like pinned down by like a chimera in the desert or something like that, and it was like stinging him. It was just pinning him down and stinging him with its scorpion tail. And he's like, I'm okay. We're friends. He's really nice. And
it's
we're like,
you don't understand his past, you guys. He had a hard childhood.
Exactly. And those were really fun experiences for us that I thought were fairly obviously telegraphed to be not friendly creatures. But, you know, Brigley still insisted on trying to befriend them and interact with them. He basically was just very, like, thirsty for that druid life. He really wanted to be a druid.
Yes.
He was a rogue, and he so desperately wanted that sweet, sweet nature magic. And he really put in the work to try and earn it, honestly. I think all of these weird experiences with getting beaten up by every single animal that he ran into for, like, 3 years made it so that it felt earned when he actually got that kind of druid magic.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, it essentially turned him into the ultimate druid, which is Steve Irwin.
Yeah, totally.
Yes, who can befriend any animal he meets, unless it's a stingray, RIP.
Wow. Well, too soon.
Not too soon. It's fine.
he pretty much is like fantasy Steve Irwin, honestly.
He really is, yeah.
I hadn't really thought about that.
You're welcome. Sam, so we've got a few examples of some magical, or even like, I have one. Two of mine are technically sort of a sci-fi creature.
We do have some. We also do have a few listener questions. Do you want to talk about ours first, or should we just talk about a few listener ones?
You can rattle those off
quick.
Give us some user examples.
We had some pretty fun ones. We said, look, what are your favorite animals? What are your favorite creatures you've run into? What are some interesting sort of magic traits of animals? We actually had, I thought this was really funny, from Tim Devine, that's at GM Tim D, previous guest on the podcast, friend of the show, frequent listener to the show, said that in a 2-year-long Star Wars campaign they made, their group went out of their way to basically try and collect every single creature they came across.
A sci-fi zoo?
Yeah, to make like a sci-fi zoo, essentially. And he was like,
how did they carry it with them? Did they have a really big ship? An actual ark?
He said later, he was like, we should have called the ship the Menagerie. That would have been like the best possible name for a sci-fi ship. They ended up calling it the Thunderdome, which is also kind of a cool name for a ship, I suppose.
Only if they made their animals fight each other in death battles.
Maybe. That would be kind of cool, actually. That seems like a thing that if you were like a weird smuggler, you go to all these weird planets, you run into all kinds of weird alien monsters, and you say, well, this will probably be worth something to somebody. You collect them on your ship, and you say, you know, you stop in Mos Eisley or whatever, and you say, all these weird, you know, kind of roughneck backwater guys, they want some entertainment. Why don't I have them bet on these, you know,
well,
weird,
that's literally
monsters.
Jeff Goldblum's The Game Master from
Ragnarok. Right.
He collects slaves and makes them fight in his Thunderdome.
You're absolutely right.
I'm a rockman. Just pile of rocks.
Another early Rec Room recommendation, go watch Thor Ragnarok for the, you know, three people in the world who haven't seen Thor Ragnarok.
Because it's so good.
It's very, very good. So we had another one from Chris Knapp, another friend of the show, that's at Nat1Advice. He said for them, his part, it's usually a 50-50 split between befriending and killing, so he's kind of got to stay on his toes. Usually it doesn't really go the way you expect, right? If you think of, you know, like we said, I tried to telegraph really hard that, well, it's a mean old alligator who obviously looks hungry and he wants to beat you up, and somehow Brigley still thought it was a good idea to try and befriend him, right?
Yeah.
That's just kind of how it goes. He said that once his players were tasked with retrieving a branch from a pine tree in the Feywild, and they were attacked by a swarm of bioluminescent hummingbirds for their trouble.
Goodness.
Which sounds really cool. Like, you know, just fireflies that, you know, flitter around like a crazy hummingbird and have long, sharp beaks.
Yeah.
Maybe instead of drinking sweet nectar, they drink your blood or something. I don't know.
Sounds terrifying.
Yeah, it sounds very terrifying.
Anything that comes in the form of a swarm is just kind of impossible, unless you have some sort of like huge like fire blast you can send out. I feel like there's nothing, if you're just like sort of a normal kind of punch and slash combat, you'd be screwed.
Yeah. No, totally. Totally. I do think it's really interesting that, you know, it's one thing to imagine a caveman or something going out and hunting a deer with a, you know, a spear and a sword or something. It's a very different thing to imagine, hunting like I don't know, a displacer beast, you know, like a weird, like, many-tailed cat monster that can teleport around and, you know, like, suddenly be on top of you. And, yeah, it, you couldn't really reasonably, as just a regular old fighter with no magical abilities, hunt a lot of the things you come across in D&D typically.
Okay, this is a really good segue into something that I was trying to think earlier about how I could bring up when talking about examples of, like, creatures from other fiction that we want to draw inspiration from.
Yeah.
Because I was honestly, I was thinking a lot about King Kong, what year was it? The one that I like with Jack Black
Naomi Watts. That would have been like probably 2017 or 2018 maybe.
No.
Oh, you're not talking
2009
about...
2009 or something.
Yes, you're talking about the earlier... The
Jack Black and Naomi Watts.
Directed by...
isn't it Lord of the Rings
Lord of the Rings guy, Hobbit guy, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Well, that one. Yeah. I love that one. And come at me if you disagree. But I was trying to think of how to like incorporate those creatures and beasts. And I felt like, no, King Kong is too much of a sort of a sentient player within the story. He can't really be an animal that you talk about.
Peter Jackson,
fairly.
Anybody asks us on Twitter.
But the way we were talking just now about like the swarming of like beasts around you, I think one of the most beautiful and frightening scenes in that movie is when a lot of the main guys, they fall into that pit and it's just kind all the insects come and start eating them. And
it's a really scary scene.
It's very scary and upsetting. Yeah. And I think what makes it PG-13. So scary is that like it plays this very solemn, slow music as everyone is slowly getting devoured by insects and leeches. Who is the guy who does? He's the king of stop motion. No, not stop motion. He's the king
Andy Serkis.
Yes, Andy Serkis of mocap.
Mocap, yeah.
He
plays a leech in that movie.
He plays a live action man.
They tied him up like a little mummy, made him crawl on the ground like leech with ping pong balls all over him.
He would, though. Yeah, he seriously
totally would.
No, I mean, he did do the mocap for King Kong, but he also played a live action character. He was Cookie, the
cook. He played a literal cookie.
Yes,
actually.
He was a cook aboard the ship, and there's a very spooky scene, and I've seen him talk about this in an interview, where he's like devoured slowly by leeches, like one grabs each limb, and he showed that movie to his kids, and they got really scared when they saw that scene. They're like, Dad, and he's like, we're gonna skip it, we're fast forwarding, it's fine.
I feel like if I was an actor, I would only show my kids the scenes where I die in horrible ways, just to like mess with them.
Oh my god, that's so
they
mean.
They would always be worried that I would never come back from a job, right?
That's
they'd be
awful,
like,
Sam.
Does Dad like really get like hurt when he does these? Is he really gonna die one of these days? Like, is this like some method stuff? Do they actually have to have him eaten by leeches?
We'll never have children, so it's fine. We don't have to deal with that.
Those are, I think, really good examples of like just the random types of animals that would adapt to a given situation. I think that is something that. That movie, whatever, I can take it or leave it. But I do think it makes a lot of sense that you would say, okay, well, it's an island that, you know, a gorilla can grow to be gigantic. Why wouldn't all the other animals on this island also be able to grow to be gigantic? There should be giant leeches and giant birds and giant dinosaurs and whatever else
that,
is living there.
That premise, which is, I think, exciting about it, it's based on realism.
Yeah.
Obviously not that things can get to be as big as we see them in that movie, but there is an actual trend in islands
island
of
either gigantism you're talking about.
Island gigantism or island like miniaturism.
Yeah.
There are like, for example, in the Key Islands in Florida, the Florida Keys, there are like very small deer.
Yeah.
And it's because like somehow some deer swam out there or got out there somehow. And then the way it evolved, it just got smaller and smaller.
Yeah, there wasn't enough food for them or you
exactly.
know, it was.
But it's like the reverse of those crabs that ate Amelia Earhart. Like they evolved.
Crabs.
Yes, exactly. On this island and they became humongous because there was nothing there to eat them. So it's kind of this weird balance of how does your environment treat you and how do you exist in this space
completely.
That determines what your body looks like or how you evolve. And I think that's so cool.
The ecological interactions between these animals and their environments are definitely one of the biggest things that I think we want to touch on in this episode.
Exactly.
So to say, like what kind of predators are around? Are there other animals that are predators for this? Are you a predator? What does that say? What does that say about... you know, this animal, like how does that inform their evolutionary path? Do they become really big? Do they become really small?
Yes.
You know, you have pygmy elephants on some islands and you have giant elephant birds that are, you know, 15 feet tall that can, you know, crush a man in between their toes or whatever. That's really, really cool to me.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that's what we should be drawing inspiration from. Yeah. So I have a couple of things on my list of actual things. Do you want to go first since I just talked about King Kong?
I was just looking at the Twitter thing. There's actually one more listener one that I want to share because it's really cool.
Well, then go for it.
I'll retweet this because there's some really cool art attached to this. Rich Oxenham, that's at HatchlingDM on Twitter, sent us a picture of what he just calls the questing beast, which is basically, it's like a cheetah's body with like a cobra's head, and essentially it's just like it's a super fast beast that can kind of just appear anywhere, and it's sort of this like nemesis for their players that it just sort of, it'll suddenly be there, and
that's spooky.
There's a really, really cool drawing that he tweeted at us of this creature. It's really, really awesome. It's got like a cheetah's body and a cobra's head, and then it's got a snake tail wrapped around a cheetah's tail. It's really, really neat. And just imagine something that, you know, once it kind of, it's like the ultimate hunter, right? Once it sort of gets a sense of you, once it gets your smell in its nostrils, it will never let go, right?
Well, I can,
until you leave its territory or until you leave the, you know, its hunting grounds or something like that.
Just from that drawing, I can picture the way that it moves. Yeah. It's incredibly fast, but like anything with a snake like influence has this kind of like bobbing and weaving sort of like side to side element to it, which I think is really exciting.
Absolutely.
It actually makes me think of an alien race that I developed for my sci-fi story, The Nebulous Tide. They're called Kallians, and they're supposed to be this sort of like a combination between something similar of that, where it's sort of like a wolf, but sort of a snake-like creature in the way that it like, it has this very long neck and it just kind of like slithers and writhes its way through an environment and moves exceptionally fast.
I think that's also a really good way to make something very creepy is make it move wrong,
right?
You know,
exactly.
Like have it, if it's something with a human-like body but it doesn't move like a human, right? Or if it's the thing that I think of is in Carrie, the original Carrie, how at the end of the movie there's a scene where she sort of walks in like this creepy way, and the way they did it was they filmed her walking backwards and then played the footage in reverse.
So
there's just something sort of uncanny about the way they move. If it's a human-like creature moving like an animal, or an animal-like creature, you know, when you see like a cat stand on its hind legs,
it's spooky.
It's weird.
It's sort of weird. Ooh, why are you doing that?
You don't really like it, right? Generally speaking. So I think that can be a really interesting trait. You know, those really kind of subtle details about a thing, the way that it moves and the way that it carries itself,
yes,
can tell you a lot about a creature and can kind of inform, like, is this thing creepy and weird and evil, or is it just like a normal thing?
Well, definitely. I was kind of inspired by just like footage I had seen from, and this is, I don't know, tell me if this is weird or not. I haven't actually played Left 4 Dead, but I've seen lots of footage from it, and I've seen lots of fan art for it.
I have played Left 4 Dead, so listeners who are Left 4 Dead fans, one of us is able to talk about this.
There you go. I was somewhat inspired by what I've seen of the witches. Aren't they called witches?
Yeah.
Where they kind of rock and moan to themselves until you aggravate them, and then they go wild and ballistic and they come at you full fury. And that's kind of what I was picturing for this creature, is that in like states of calm, when it doesn't sense like a prey around it, it would kind of be like rocking back and forth in this unsettling sense. And then if it smells anything, it would just come riddling at you.
Totally.
And it would just be like horrifying.
The thing, and like the thing about the witches is that it's kind of interesting that they're always kind of preoccupied with for them specifically, it's that they're really sad about the loss of a loved one or something. You know, they died while they were mourning someone, and that consumes them now, right? It's not a hunger, it's a sadness. And now if you disturb them in their mourning, they want to come after you and get revenge because they'll blame you for it. I'm sure there's like a specific lore for them that I don't remember because I haven't played Left 4 Dead in like 10 years.
Yeah. But still, inspiring.
Yeah, it's really, really cool. I remember a lot of really, really fun kind of interactions in that game where, you know, you're going through the levels and then suddenly you see a witch and you're like, okay, everyone, quiet. Yeah, we sneak around.
Walk carefully.
Yeah.
I love that.
That there would be an animal that you treat the same way.
Right.
You know, like, it's sort of like the opposite of a bear. If you're walking through the woods, you're supposed, if you're in bear country, you're supposed to make a lot of noise because
the bears avoid you.
Yeah, exactly. The way for a bear to be really dangerous is for you to surprise a bear, right? So you always want to be shouting or singing a song or have like a cowbell around your neck or whatever. So a bear will hear you before it sees you and probably run off, right? But if you stumble upon a bear, all of a sudden it's going to go buck wild and attack you, right?
Yeah.
Just like a witch.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Very cool. Okay.
Yeah.
So then, on that note, I do have a few examples that I want to give.
We can talk about our actual examples here now.
So my first example of a fictional creature that I am very inspired by, in delving further into the stories and lore behind like the original Star Trek series, mm-hmm. I was so enchanted to find that Spock, as a child, he talks about how he had this pet, and it's called, the species is called a Salat. And essentially it's a salad. A Salat, I think is how you pronounce it. S-E-H-L-A-T. Mm. But it's essentially a saber-toothed bear-like creature.
Yes, you've told me about this before, I think.
It's enormous. And what I think is so cute about this concept is that the Vulcans, being such a, like, they don't embrace emotion. It's all about logic for them. But the fact that they could, like, it said, I looked up a Wikipedia about it just before we started, and it said that Salats are often pets given to children to teach them responsibility.
Yeah.
But like the idea that, I mean, you have to naturally...
buy someone a bear to teach them responsibility. Yeah.
Well, it said in the article, it said that children learn very quickly that they must feed their animal in a timely manner, otherwise they will see the aggression within the beast.
Yeah.
But I feel like, because I've just seen so much fan art of like little Spock, like cuddling with his Salat and like sleeping against this giant bear. And it's so cute. And I think there's a line from one of the like TV shows or, a novelization where he talks about, he's talking with a human character about how they have dogs and stuff. And he's like, well, we have that too, but they're more like vicious bears who could kill you if they wanted to. And yeah. It's just really interesting that you have, they somehow domesticated this animal, but they did it through logic and through these things, but it's this huge beast that they just have in their home and they give to their children.
I think it's interesting because there is like a real world parallel to that, right? I mean, we have, you know, dogs are domesticated, they're man's best friend, mm-hmm. right? But all dogs are descended from wolves. And at some point, you know, millions of years ago, somebody took a wolf, which is, you know, they're viewed as the kind of quintessential sort of evil animal. You know, they're looked at as sort of a force of evil in mythological context.
And just like fairy stories.
Yeah, and fairy
stories.
The wolf
is always the bad guy.
Yeah, wolves are always the bad guys. But at some point, somebody saw a wolf and said, that could be my friend. And, mm-hmm. and turned it into a friend. That's a really interesting concept.
I agree.
I think, to include in the story.
It's also just the fact that I feel like anytime when we think from our human perspective of having a pet, it's about sort of this, there's a huge emotional connection between you and this animal.
Yeah.
And one thing that's so interesting to view for me, Vulcans having pets, is that they wouldn't, you wouldn't think that they would attach a lot of emotional connection to this, yeah. this creature. But there's like, it's been said by Spock and other Vulcans that they say, it's not that we don't feel emotions. We feel them very deeply.
Yeah.
We just don't express them and we don't let them control us. Mm. And so like that.
Very healthy, Spock.
Oh yes. Very healthy.
keep it all down inside you. Never talk about it.
Conceal it. Don't feel it. Learn from Elsa. She was a Vulcan.
Exactly.
But yeah, what do you got for some other examples?
Okay, so I had a couple here. I want to touch on first. So we talked about the concept of island gigantism or island minimalism. Mm-hmm. I just think the idea of like megafauna is so cool.
Yeah.
That, you know, there used to be like giant sloths and cave bears.
So
and,
cool.
And, you know, animals that were basically the animals we have today, except
10 times bigger.
Yeah.
Cool.
And specifically one that I know you are a ride or die for this animal, Piper, is the Scottish elk.
Oh my God.
The
yes.
humongous, like, you know, 15-foot tall elk with a, you know, 300-pound set of antlers. So cool. I really like the sort of primal. Piper's literally dancing as I'm talking about
this.
She's
little
so
happy
excited
dance.
About the Scottish elk.
I love an Irish elk. It's so
Irish
good.
Irish elk. Thank you. The idea of like, this, I could totally see a person, you know, walking through the woods and seeing this animal that is really just a regular mundane animal. There's nothing magical about them, but thinking this must be some kind of like forest god or forest spirit. It's so great and so humongous and powerful. It can't just be a regular animal, right? That sort of primal nature,
right.
the idea that an animal is that impressive is really, really cool to me. I like the idea of something that is sort of like the master of its domain, even if it is just an herbivore. Nobody would see a giant Irish elk with 1,000 prongs coming off of its antlers and think, I want to mess with that guy.
Well, seriously, I mean, I think the closest thing we have today are some bull moose that you might encounter.
Totally.
I mean, those things are massive, but the
totally.
Irish elk was even bigger than that.
Yeah.
But you can actually bring this into a fantasy setting because I don't know if this has any weight within the novels, but I remember in the movies, the Hobbit movies, we see There's that great high elf, and he's riding an Irish elk. That's his steed.
Yeah. So that's
it's Legolas's father.
Thranduil, you're talking about.
And yeah.
I believe. Okay. So look, you're testing my lore here. Right?
I know. I am. I'm giving you a bone, Sam. Take it away.
So Thranduil isn't really like featured in the Hobbit book in quite the same way as he's featured in the movie, right?
They kind of turned him into a main character. Like, in the movie. Yeah.
Like, well, we got Lee Pace. We want to like turn him into
sweet Lee Pace.
Those thick ass eyebrows.
Hell yeah. That smolder.
But I'm pretty sure in the book The Hobbit, which weirdly, you know, I reread The Lord of the Rings like twice a year. I reread The Silmarillion all the time. I haven't read The Hobbit in a couple of years, actually.
So you don't recall his noble steed?
I recall his noble steed, but I'm pretty sure it's basically just like a passing mention. I think they talk about Thranduil and they're like, yeah, Thranduil, he rides an elk sometimes, and they don't really make a big deal about it or talk about it much beyond that. The Battle of Five Armies is about one of the worst interpretations of a book imaginable, because it's like completely made up, like just from nothing that happens in that movie. I'm gonna dial it back here. I'm getting worked up.
It's okay.
Everyone
take it
knows.
Easy. It's
I'm
chill.
Not a fan.
It's chill. Well, that just says that Peter Jackson
cool that
like maybe read like one line in that book and said, "Well, let's just elaborate on that,"
yeah.
Which I think is kind of fun.
Yeah, I can't really judge. I mean, the whole nature of the show is that we take things that exist and sort of build on them and expand
exactly.
upon them.
I
do think it's interesting that he would say, "Okay, look, like." Thranduil, he rode an elk. What does that look like?
Yeah.
You know, in practice, you know, if we just mention that in passing in the books, sure, that's great, but I want to see it. You know,
exactly. Making it an Irish
cool.
elk makes it incredibly imposing and powerful.
Yeah,
so
that makes perfect
way
sense.
To go. Good,
yeah.
good adaptation. Says
absolutely.
I.
Absolutely. Yeah. I love a good Irish elk. Pepper, you get another one here?
Yes, I do. So my next creature that I wrote down for my list is actually the Ikran, also known as the Banshee from Avatar.
Ooh.
James Cameron's Avatar. And these are the creatures that they ride, the hunters ride, the Na'vi people. And the whole, what I think really draws me to this animal is just that I have watched the behind the scenes of James Cameron's Avatar many times.
Piper's opinion of Avatar is the opposite of my opinion of the Hobbit films. Like, literally, you couldn't. Like, find a more polarized
oh my god no yeah. I love it, but also so in here's a little plug for another podcast, when we appeared on Dog Hair Presents,
yes,
from our good friend Rory, I talked about an artist, I talked about the artist Wayne Barlow, who is this demonic artist and storyteller, but he also has designed some of the coolest creatures ever seen in cinema.
Oh, yeah.
Including things from Hellboy and Pacific Rim, and also he designed a lot of the look of the creatures of Pandora from James Cameron's Avatar.
And also, we learned recently, was an inspiration for Starfinder.
Exactly. Yes.
Some of his art and some of his creations and things.
Well, in the 80s, he created this sort of... alien encyclopedia in which he just came up with all of these like the history and how these creatures like mate and how they evolve and how they eat and breed, and it was just so in depth and so cool. He designed the Ikran, these large flying kind of pterodactyl creatures, and I just love just the thought put into them, because I feel like a lot of big movies these days, they might design a creature but it just looks cool.
It doesn't make sense in its environment.
Exactly. This they really put thought into, like, well, they're like, well, we wanted to have four wings, why would it evolve that way? And they really gave some good thought into that, and the whole, I don't know, just the way that the writers like connect with their creatures, and this idea that it's like, once you form this bond with your animal, that's, you're with them for the rest of your life.
I do think something that is really interesting about Avatar is the idea that pretty much everything in that world is like symbiotic with something else, right?
Yes.
They really say what you will about, you know, whether that's like a subtle way to tell a story, or if, you know, if it's like, if it's unique, or I know people are like, well, it's Ferngully in space or whatever. It kind of is.
And it's Pocahontas,
exactly.
Dances with Wolves.
But is an interesting sort of ecology. I think the world building in that is absolutely the best part of it.
Absolutely.
100%.
And that's what I personally am so looking forward to when it comes to the sequels, is because now that we've established this world, now we can really delve into it and see what lies underneath the surface.
Piper Cleveland is the reason that the Avatar movie was the highest grossing film of all time. In case anyone didn't know, Piper saw this movie 73 times in theaters.
I'm so excited for the sequels. I can't wait.
Piper is the only person in the world that feels that Avatar is like an important film.
That is such a lie. There are many of us, and we shall rise again.
There are literally tens of us.
Oh my God, there are tens of thousands of us. You don't even know. Ask all of China. They fucking love it.
Yeah.
Anyway, what's another animal you've got?
Okay, so one quick one kind of touching on... So talking about megafauna, right? I really like the idea of a dire animal, right? Which is basically just like the fantasy version of megafauna, right? Mm-hmm. That you can have a bear, right? But what if you had a bear but more?
But
right?
It's the size of a tank.
A dire bear.
And
exactly.
It can shoot lasers from its eyes.
Exactly. I think that is something that's really cool about most fantasy settings have a dire version of an animal it's either, you know, slightly touched by magic, or it is, you know, it exists in a realm where it is like the apex predator. It has nothing to compete with for food or resources, and it just becomes massive.
I love that.
I like the idea of a bear that becomes... I think the touched by magic aspect of it is especially interesting because you can see sort of like mutations or like sort of differences in an animal that wouldn't really be expressed otherwise. The Dragon Age series, I think, has a really cool take on this, that in Dragon Age 1, there's like sort of a mini boss fight in the elven forest kind of area where you fight a couple of bears and you fight a bear skarn, which is basically a bear with like bony spikes growing out of it. That's kind of their take on like a bear. It's a little bit bigger. It's clearly more menacing looking. Like its design is different. You can tell immediately this is not something you want to fuck with.
I really like that. And what it makes me think of is in Princess Mononoke, the big boar that we see at the beginning of the film.
Yeah.
Yes. And he's technically like a boar god, isn't he? And I think it's similar with the wolves that Mononoke associates with.
Son, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. But the idea that these creatures have just, no one has been able to kill them. So they've gotten bigger and bigger and now they're massive and unbelievable in their size.
It's so cool. But,
which is great.
But that they do all have a weakness. Like that, you know, Okoto, spoilers for Princess Mononoke, in case you haven't seen this movie from 1997, is inflicted with the same curse that Prince Ashitaka is inflicted with.
This blight, this disease.
Yeah, exactly. It like takes him down. Like Prince Ashitaka is pure of heart and is able to kind of stave it off and overcome it. But Okoto is so filled with rage, he wants to fight back against the humans for taking their forest, that the curse consumes him and destroys him, right?
Yes.
That the idea that even these super powerful beasts, they have the same kinds of weaknesses that, you know, a normal, mundane, non-magical or, you know, not fantastical version of this creature would have, I think, is a really important aspect.
I agree.
Yeah.
I mean, just even making an animal larger than we normally would know it, I think adds a certain mystical element to it, because it requires you to ask, how did you get this way?
It's just a boar, but more.
Exactly. Yeah. A boar, but more. All right, Sam, should we dive into our kind of prompts and things?
I think we should. I actually do have one more quick kind of honorable mention for an animal. One thing I want to talk about. For some reason, I couldn't stop thinking about... We haven't really talked about inherently like magic-based creatures, right? But I do think it's important in sort of a fantasy realm to touch on at least one thing that is primarily like a magic-based creature, like from the Fae realm or from something like that. And I really love the idea of a will-o-wisp.
A
will-o'-the-wisp. And especially the kinds of interpretations you would see in a movie like Brave, that they're kind of like a guiding spirit, but they're also sort of a passive part of a place. They're not really... They're just sort of like a part of the ecology, the thing that just exists there.
Well, that's really very interesting, because I understand two definitions of a will-o'-the-wisp.
Yeah.
Previously, my first introduction to a will-o'-the-wisp was a malicious fairy that would imitate the light of a cabin in a far distance if you were lost in the woods, and you would follow it and it would lead you to fall off a cliff. It looks like a freaky lightning bug, essentially, if you saw
it
up close.
And that's like, you know, the original origin of everything is like a Brothers Grimm style.
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
It wasn't until I saw Brave that I saw will-o'-the-wisps like portrayed as a positive
kind
thing.
Kind of a benevolent.
That would, like, in that movie they talk about how it guides you to your fate. It might take you away from danger.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's very interesting, these two kind of the seesaw of these interpretations of what these things could be.
Yeah, absolutely. But for whatever reason, I just couldn't get the idea of a will-o'-wisp out of my head. And I think they're really cool. They're just sort of like magical energy and magical essence. They're just the sort of distillation of the spirit of a location, and they kind of guide you, or they mislead you, or yeah, you know, there are a lot of different,
on their mood.
Yeah, totally. They can have different alignments. Yeah.
My final shout out is the rat dogs from the movie Willow.
Rat dogs.
Yeah. Someone on that team literally just made like a cool like rat monster outfit, and they put it on a bunch of dogs, and they're like, dogs, run through this town. And these dogs ran through this town.
Of course.
They look like horrifying monsters on screen. It's a beautiful practical effect.
I'm totally team rat dog.
Hell yeah, 100%. Rat dogs. Rat dogs. Watch Willow. Yeah. Early rec room. It's great.
Second rec room. Okay. All right. So we have gone through a lot of really cool options here for, you know, pre-existing inspirational types of creatures for your worlds. But let's go ahead and get to the real meat and potatoes of the show and
exactly.
do our own creations here, Piper.
All right. So Sam, you are going to generate some biomes based on the biomes of our known Earth, our known world.
Yeah.
And then I am going to generate a random word that is going to spice up these biomes.
Yeah. So we are not, this is kind of a different, spoilers, oh, a different
format. We're doing something
different
this format. Week.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
We're not modifying the creatures we're creating. We're modifying the modifier. We're modifying the sort of biome. So I'm going to go ahead and do a good old spin job here. We are ticking down to our first prompt. Piper, you have got a temperate grassland.
Awesome. I love a grassland. Yeah. Okay. And the first word that I got... Okay. Well, I got oil was the
oil.
Word that I
Ooh,
got.
Okay. Oil.
So an oil grassland. So this says to me that this is a place... I mean, if you picture a grassland, you picture sort of rolling hills, waving... amber waves of grain. Very American. There should be a beautiful
A bald
musical.
Eagle is flying overhead, and there's a flag waving in the background, like
exactly.
halfway, like faded.
It's
constantly.
Gorgeous. I also, with the word oil, I picture what we would see when driving through like a North or South Dakota or a
like
Texas.
The oil dairies.
Exactly.
Yeah.
These like oil nodding donkeys.
Yeah, I was
just
going to say,
like,
if you don't explain
the oil,
the nodding donkeys.
Of course, these machines that are pumping the oil. And so, but I don't want to introduce any sort of like humans to this world yet. I feel as if maybe there's a lot of oil under this place, but there's also some, like, maybe it's close enough to an area sort of similar to the American Yellowstone National Park, which is the largest volcano in America, mm-hmm. technically. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of pressure built under the ground. And so maybe this oil, it's just like forced to the surface and it's kind of bubbling up.
Okay, I like that.
So it's a grassland that also has these periodic, like just like geysers of oil that would like shoot out every now and then. That's kind of the...
I like that. Okay,
the land that I'm picturing.
Do you feel like... Well,
or
okay,
there'd be like little tar
off,
pits that bubble up too.
Oh, I like the tar pit idea.
Yeah.
Okay. One, I want to just rewind for a second because like I pointed out the nodding donkeys because... I just figured it would be worth explaining that it's a cute thing that you say, like, nodding donkeys is what you thought oil dairies looked like
yeah,
a little,
they look
a little
like,
donkey. Yeah, for all of our listeners
term,
who are
it?
Like, what are you... No, I don't think anyone else calls them
is
nodding donkeys.
Is it just
donkeys.
Me that calls them
I'm
nodding donkeys?
I'm pretty sure it's just you that calls the oil dairies nodding donkeys.
Okay, well,
so
they look like donkeys, and they're, like, nodding their heads.
Like, what is Piper talking about? What is this lunatic talking about right now? nodding donkeys are the little oil dairies. But,
yeah, the guys that pump up all the oil
yes.
by nodding their donkey heads.
Exactly. I really love the idea of an animal that would have to adapt to, maybe it's like an animal that adapts to the tar pits, or maybe it's an animal that adapts to a valuable resource like oil being found in a location. Like, how would it react to humans or orcs or elves or, you know, whatever like powerful force coming in and trying to exploit the land for something?
Right. Well, so the first thing that I picture is that if these oil geysers are unpredictable, I picture a prey type animal that would need to be aware of these elements that are going to suddenly burst out from the ground.
Totally. So it has to be fast.
Yes. So it needs to be fast. I'm picturing something that's rather small, skittish, with like large ears kind of. So something sort of like a rabbit, but it has, I want it to be kind of like with like the fast agility with like the little hands of like maybe like a mouse kind of a thing.
Okay.
So
like kind of like a miniature like deer rabbit or like a jackalope type situation kind of, right?
Exactly.
Like, yeah.
So I think my creature is something that needs to have, it looks, I think the closest thing it resembles is a rabbit that we would know, but it needs to have these enormous ears that will like, it'll, the ears will go down and like touch the ground and kind of lay against the earth and listen for the vibrations to sense when a geyser is about to erupt.
But answer me this, Piper, do their ears hang low?
And they wobble to and fro.
Okay,
and
cool.
You can tie them in a knot, and you can tie them in a bow. Yes.
They probably hate that, though.
Well, yes, they would. They would not like that at all.
Tourists often come and visit and try to tie their ears into bows, and it just really grinds their gears.
Yeah. So I think these ears, they touch the ground, and that's what they do, is they kind of sit there with their little noses twitching while they're listening for vibrations in the earth, and they feel it in their paws.
Cool.
I also think it's very important that they have these really big feet, kind of like how a lynx or a bobcat who can walk across the snow. It needs to have these enormous paws with webbed feet, so just in case it happens to be sprinting for its life and it runs into a tar pit, it can maybe more easily kind of like splash across the surface of the tar.
Yeah, it has like its surface area stretched out further, so it can move across these tar pits.
So it's less likely to get sucked into the tar if it needs to escape its prey.
And it also can like feel the vibrations. It has very like sensitive paws that it can tell when something is coming. It has hearing, but it also has like kind of physical like hearing through the ground.
Exactly.
Ew.
Yeah.
Cool.
So this is, I guess, imagine a mix between a hare, an American like Western hare, that is a rabbit with very large ears and a very large body, but who has lynx and bobcat like paws and feet which are widely webbed. And its ears normally drape upon the ground, except when it maybe hears a predator who would be... I think that the predators in this area might be large birds or...
That makes sense, because I think things that take to the sky that kind of... They can not make vibrations in the ground,
right?
You know, or make noise. They would be like a snowy owl that can be like really, really quiet, so they can,
not
be heard by them.
Yeah, so this creature needs to constantly be having its ears to the earth to listen for the geysers, and its ears ready to like jump up to the sky to listen to an overhead predator. So
here's what I'll post a picture of this, but here's what I think it looks like. I just drew a picture of Piper.
That's so cute.
It's just a rabbit with big ass paws.
I love it. Just a big foot rabbit.
It's just a big foot rabbit. It's definitely a big foot rabbit.
Let's call it like a tar foot. I think that's what it's called.
Ooh, I like that.
So my first creature is a tar foot.
I like that. That's a really good name right away. All right, tar
foot. Thank you. Okay.
That seems like the thing that, the first... people who would see this animal skittering across in the same way as like, there's the lizards that can run across the water.
Right.
They would see this and say, oh, that's yon tarfoot escapeth over yonder oil dairy.
Here's another detail that I think, because I do picture it being a fuzzy, like a furry creature. I think what it does when it's not eating, which is a majority part of its day, it spends a huge amount of time just like cleaning itself, and it secretes these natural oils in its saliva that it's coating its fur with. So when it runs across the tar, the oil will slide off of its body.
It's an oil that is like hydrophobic or oil phobic to the tar oil.
Exactly.
Maybe they just sweat a lot. Maybe that's it.
It could be a very sweaty
water
rabbit.
And oil don't mix. Yeah, the sweaty rabbit.
Yeah, I think it eats. It seeks out very
the
like
sweaty rabbit of North Dakota.
It seeks out very like water. Rich flora that it eats, and then it like coats itself in this kind of oil that would be able to repel the tar that it runs across when fleeing from its prey.
I like that a lot.
Very cool. Okay.
Do you think it has some type of organ that it holds water in? Like it has that fish have like a swim bladder that they can fill with air to like, control their buoyancy. Does it have some
that
type
makes
of,
sense. Maybe it should be
like
sort
hump,
of like
a camel.
I was going to say it should be like it should look like a hunchback.
I'm adding two humps to this drawing.
Very nice. Yeah, I think it should have a very distinct hump, and it looks when if you were to see it, you would think that looks like the slowest creature ever, but it can just like pew, like sprint off like
cool.
Who knows, like flying, like its limbs flying everywhere as it like pads across the oil fields.
I like that. Okay, this is great.
Awesome.
That's a really good starting point.
So that's
point
the tarfoot.
I've got for my biome here, archipelago. So like a series of islands, a marine / terrestrial creature. I like the idea that it can kind of traverse between land and water. Maybe it's evolving from water onto land, or maybe it's like an iguana, or it can be both. Yeah. I'm just trying to just BSing while you're pulling up the prompt here. Honestly, I was trying to.
So your biome is sort of an island based biome.
Yes.
Well, now it is also a smoke island.
Oh,
biome.
I like this. Okay.
The word is smoke.
So this makes me think immediately of So here's a little trivia fact for all of our listeners. So I went to Iceland a couple years ago, and Reykjavik, Iceland, the capital city of Iceland, is named after the bay that, you know, Reykjavik is on. And Reykjavik literally means like the foggy bay or the smoky bay.
Nice.
And the reason they called it that was because the hot springs, which issued off steam, the Vikings that originally traveled there, they saw the steam coming up and they thought it was smoke from a fire. And they said, it's this bay and there's, you know, smoke coming up, the smoky bay, right? I like the idea of a creature that kind of exists in sort of like a hot springs type area, or like a, you know, like a, you know, quote unquote smoky type area like mm-hmm. this, that, you know, people maybe would think that it's giving off smoke, but really it's giving off steam or,
yeah,
or heat or something. So it's something is volcanic about it, or it's acclimated to a hot environment.
Well, this makes me think of how early civilizations, if they were to witness a creature living in this place, they might think something like how people often thought salamanders
yes.
were fire creatures because of they course. Saw them running away from the flames. And they think, oh, it came from the flames. But maybe your animal is simply accustomed to and evolved to withstand these heats
yeah,
and these things.
Totally.
But people attribute magical elements to it, whether or not that's true.
Totally. Yeah. And I would picture maybe this is an animal. Maybe it is. It's some kind of like a, you know, like a lungfish, like an animal that it's like a fish that it lives in the water, but it can crawl around on land for like short periods of time.
Like a mudskipper.
Exactly. And maybe because it can survive in these really hot environments, it's around like volcanic archipelagos and it's viewed as maybe like a blessing for smiths or something. Maybe this is like a, in the same way like crickets are kind of viewed as like good luck creatures, having a cricket on your hearth,
yeah,
having this like smoke beast is viewed as good luck if you're a smith to have one on your mantle. So maybe smiths are going out and trying to capture these little fish and putting them in little fish tanks or whatever,
huh,
and keep them up on their above the anvil or above the forge or something like that.
That's very curious. How big do you picture these creatures being?
I think they're probably, well, okay.
Because if they were large, that'd be something that'd be very hard to like bring back
yeah.
with you. If it's something small, you can maybe put it in a bowl and it would live a few weeks.
I like
maybe.
The idea of them being like kind of like a koi fish, right? That
okay.
like a koi, you know, they start like very small, but they can live, you know, hundreds of years and eventually just grow and grow. And they just continue to grow as long as they live, right? So if they live supremely long, if they're well taken care of, if maybe like...
You would find one the size of a whale.
Exactly. If like a very rich... blacksmith who is like very well off, who's been very successful, captures one, it would live on for so long that eventually it would be massive. Like it would just be way too big. And maybe there is,
but
like,
where was he keeping them?
And maybe there's like one like king forge fish or something. That's probably what they call it. They would call it like the forge fish.
So that what makes me picture is a, you would, like, if you were seeking out this great forge master,
yeah.
his forge would be located, like, on this cliff face by the sea.
Yeah.
And beneath his forge is this cavern where this massive fish is swimming around,
yeah.
like, creating steam,
totally.
Essentially.
Totally.
To, like, heat his forge.
Totally. And I think maybe it's just incidental that they also give off steam. Maybe, you know, maybe they breathe in, like, the sulfuric acid or something as they give off the steam. And people maybe think they power the volcanoes.
Yeah.
But really, they just live there. They have nothing to do with, you know, the tectonic movement of the plates. They just happen to survive in these areas, and people attribute this skill to them, which is, it's more of like an evolutionary adaptation than anything else, right? And I would imagine their scales are like kind of black obsidian glass type scales.
I like
this
that.
Really cool, like shiny, glistening, like stone hard scales that they have, kind of like a dragon would have. It would like metallic type scales, but
yeah.
out of obsidian stone.
And if you were a true
yeah.
forge master and you had one of these large fish that was like heating your forge or whatever,
yeah.
you could, if you befriended it and you fed it and it cared for you equally, you could have its trust that you could go down and pry off a scale or two to make some really
yeah.
impressive
well,
armor.
And they probably like shed scales in the same way as, you know, like a snake sheds its skin or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, that'd
and
be really cool.
I like the idea that this creature is sort of owning one is like a prestigious thing. You know, every blacksmith wants to have the biggest forge fish.
Because it means that they
have the hottest, most powerful forge, because these creatures thrive in a carbon-rich, heat-rich, like sulfuric environment.
Well, I love the idea that if your forge fish is rather small, that maybe instead of just like coals or wood that's like feeding the fire, it could be like boiling water, essentially. Yeah. And the reason it's boiling is because this fish is swimming
because of the steam
in that water, and the fish's body temperature is so hot that it makes the water like boil, and it fuels your forge.
Maybe the fish feeds off of like the volcanic fumes. It feeds off of sulfur or something like that, and so it can generate heat, but again, it doesn't power volcanoes,
right?
It just also happens
to live
there,
but it can produce its own heat.
I also see this as a really good partner to, like, dwarves would probably love this type of animal. Like, dwarves especially would be obsessed with this, because they, you know, you don't have a ton of animals that live in caves that you can kind of cultivate as pets. And I think this animal would be kind of philosophically aligned with a lot of the ideas of dwarven culture, like that, you know, you have to have the hottest forges so you can, you know, you have to mine the greatest ores and smelt the most, you know, the most valuable, like, gold and mithril, and this fish can help us do that, right?
I love that. A good old cave fish is always good.
The cultural connection to this animal, I think, would be really significant with a creature like a dwarf, or like a, you know, like a drow that lives underground, or even like gnomes that like to tinker and work with high quality metals and things. I think could see a significant amount of value to this type of creature.
I like that. I'm picturing the videos that I see of like trainers from like SeaWorld who like work with beluga whales.
Yeah.
Like a huge beluga will like come out of the water and like nuzzle it, and the trainer can like rub its tongue or whatever. And like, I just imagine this like forge master would go down and this huge fish would breach from the water.
A giant glistening glass black koi fish.
Exactly. Yeah. And the steam comes rolling off of its hot body, and like the little forge master, you know, he gives it a scratch and he feeds it some bugs or fish or whatever else it wants to eat. And then it goes down and continues to heat his forge.
It probably has to eat like those giant like prehistoric dragonflies, right?
Sounds cool to me. Yeah,
that seems very cool.
I like it.
Ooh, I like the forge fish.
The forge fish.
Cool.
Awesome. Okay, give me another prompt, because I've got a word here.
Giving you another prompt here, Piper.
What's my next biome?
Your next biome. We have so many cool biomes. I kind of wish we could do something for every biome, right? Like, this should be a series of episodes where
That'd be really fun.
Revisit this and do, you know, tweet at us if you enjoy this episode, if you want to hear us do more animals in more different biomes, because this is a very, I think, an important kind of foundational thing in D&D, having just the basic ecology. These don't have to be animals that you fight. They're just parts of the culture of your world that can really inform a lot of the kind of stories and experiences that your players have in this world. And those sort of little flavor details add so much, I think. The insignificant things often add a lot more than the really important, like,
that's
big
what really puts
things.
All the thought into everything.
Yeah.
I agree.
But so I've got a new biome for you here, Piper. And what you've got is forest.
Just general forest?
Yeah, just a general forest. So,
not a deciduous forest?
Nope. Yeah, I think you can decide if it's like a deciduous forest or a coniferous forest.
Oh, I don't want to choose.
Flip a coin.
Choose for me, Sam.
Coniferous.
Coniferous. So that's like a pine forest.
Yeah, it's a pine forest.
Okay, so that means it's an evergreen.
Yeah.
And let's
specifically decide that it's not like a tundra or a taiga forest. It's just like a temperate coniferous forest.
Evergreen forest, like we would find in northern Minnesota.
Yeah.
Okay, well, this is very interesting with my word, which is decay.
Ooh.
Since a forest, my forest is evergreen, it doesn't lose its, the trees don't lose their needles. They seemingly seem alive
so
forever.
So does your creature seemingly stay alive forever?
But the forest is of decay. Yeah. I think, so, Okay, so here's what I'm picturing. This forest, because it's an evergreen forest, it appears as if it's alive and lush in the coldest and harshest and most dead times of year.
Yeah.
And so I think for unexpected travelers, they would think, well, this place is fairly safe. Look at the green on the trees. I can travel through here just fine. But when you pass through this place, it's actually quite toxic. And I think the land has been cursed for some reason.
Okay.
And so when you pass...
it's got like a poisonous, or like a miasma or something like that, that's here.
Exactly.
Like an elemental sort of force.
Exactly. So if you were to walk through this forest for too long without some sort of potion or protection upon you, it would kill you and die. Okay. I think it has to be something with the way that these trees, where they bring in, because help me remember the science behind this. Trees, they bring in, what is it, carbon dioxide, release oxygen?
And they release oxygen, yeah.
Okay, so these trees, they bring in carbon dioxide,
and
but
sunlight.
Instead of...
Photosynthesis.
But instead of releasing oxygen, they release this kind of toxic gas instead. And it's something about the matrix of the trees. So it creates this poison. Okay. So things normally decay and die here, except for the trees themselves. But there would need to be a creature that had evolved here when the trees first came as well. And so it is able to also breathe the poison that comes from these trees.
I like this. This tells me we're just building Pokemon, basically. Like, we really are. We're
That's
just
fine.
Like, we're like making a poison type Pokemon. We're making a ice type Pokemon. We're making a
I love that.
Yeah, I agree.
No, it's great.
It's really neat.
Honestly, the thing that comes to mind for me are I like the idea that there are these little tree frogs that live in this
Ooh.
Poison forest, because tree frogs are often poisonous creatures.
Yeah,
they
like
secrete their own poison and such. So I think these frogs have been around as long as the trees have. And so they evolved
like
with
that.
The trees, and they learned to like breathe the poison air that they put out. And
I
so I want
do,
these.
Do they convert the poison in the air into like a liquid poison they secrete from their skin? Maybe.
Yeah, yes,
that's
definitely.
Really cool.
If you wanted to like kill a king discreetly, you might go into this forest and try and capture one of these frogs and like put it into the
like
king's
that.
Bed, and it would just being there would kill the king.
And
by
you know
its
what
toxic
I bet?
Presence.
So I okay. Here's like two things about this. I bet right. One, I love the idea that they convert. A you know, like one form of poison into a, you know, gaseous poison into like a liquid poison.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you could harvest that and put it onto a, you know, an arrow or a sword or something, right? Or maybe this frog looks like just your everyday regular, you know, toad or something.
Mm-hmm.
The only difference is that they can process this poison. So it would be like a really, it would be a favored thing among rogues and thieves and cutthroats that you would, if you find one of these, they can be disguised as your regular old everyday toad.
Right.
Yeah.
Maybe, yes.
You could trick people with them.
If you could cast a certain spell, maybe if you had this type of frog with you, you could go into a toxic environment and the frog might purify the air for you. If you could somehow.
Oh, that's really cool.
Make an agreement with the frog. I don't know.
Make an agreement. We've signed an accord with this toad.
Me and this frog, we're pals now. He's going to purify my air.
I love that idea. Okay, so like the idea of an animal, the husbandry of this animal having kind of a practical purpose, right? Like, you know, a toad isn't an animal that you can ride. It's not like a labor animal. It's not like a donkey or a horse or something like that. But there is a purpose to keeping one in your home that isn't based on superstition. It's not like how you think a forage fish is just, it brings you good luck.
Right.
It actually physically serves a mechanical purpose.
Right. It breathes in all the poison.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Totally.
I really like that.
It's like putting a piece of bread in the cookie jar to keep your cookies from drying out.
There you go. Exactly.
Except it's so that the cookies don't poison you when you eat them.
No, I really like that. Although I'm trying to think about, so if nothing else can live in this forest, what do the frogs eat? So I'm wondering, do the frogs, is it the kind of symbiotic relationship in which maybe the frogs eat like maybe the sap that the trees create, and when they eat that, maybe they poop and that creates fertilizer so the trees can continue to grow.
That's a great way to do it. Yeah, it's like the ultimate recycling sort of.
That's part of it. So I think when you enter this forest, the only sound you can hear is like the orchestra of like ribbit croaks.
I love that.
It's just a croaking forest because every tree has at least like 50 frogs on them, but there's no other animals. There's no insects or birds or mammals.
It's
just the trees and the frogs.
It's like how, you know, if you see pictures of like when the monarch butterflies migrate, you can see pictures of trees that are just covered. Like it's as though the bark is made of monarch butterflies, right?
Yes.
But instead of butterflies, it's frogs.
Yes.
It's just non-stop frogs.
Cool. I like that.
Head to toe frogs. I think non-stop frogs. This also reminds
me. Non-stop
hashtag
frogs.
Non-stop frogs. Also like the idea. So I have a lot of nostalgia for
frogs.
Just the sounds that frogs make. Yeah.
Yes,
well,
I mean it's very relaxing.
So when I was a kid, my dad and I did this really cool thing where we like volunteered to help the DNR do like an inventory of all the frogs in our neighborhood, where essentially they gave us a like a cassette tape with a bunch of frog sounds on it, and they said, listen to this cassette tape, study it. There are, you know, 10 different frog sounds that are expressed across different species of frogs on this tape. Now go out to the woods, hang out there between like 11 o'clock at night and 1 in the morning, and just listen for the frog sounds and count the frequency of like the different croaks, right? Mm-hmm. And that's how they would like count how many of a certain species of frog are in the area. It brings back really fond memories of my childhood of like going out to the woods with my dad and just counting the frog sounds.
That's really sweet.
Yeah,
I love that.
Which totally makes it seem like I grew up on the bayou. Like I grew up in like a suburb in Minnesota, but like that was a really fun experience with my dad. And I think that could also be a really interesting thing. Like, you know, we've talked about before, I think, trying to engage all the senses of your players in a D&D game.
Absolutely.
Right? When you go into a place, say, here's what it looks like, here's what it sounds like, here's what it smells like, here's what it tastes like. Having the sound of a, you know, a chorus of frogs that you can learn something about the environment you're in based on this sort of song of the frogs.
I think it's a really cool thing. So you would hear this like chorus of frogs, right? And you're like, oh, this is a forest that is very much alive.
Yeah.
But as you start to walk in from the outside, you would see lots of like just like the corpses of birds that have flown too close to the forest and dropped dead because of the toxins.
Yeah.
And if you roll a good perception check, maybe you would know to like pull a bandana over your face and to leave quickly.
That's incredible. Like any ranger would know that right away, or a druid would know that right away, but you would have to how about this? I like the idea of, you know, you walk into a normal forest and you see dead leaves on the ground, right? Mm-hmm. But you walk into this forest and instead of seeing dead leaves, you see like dead birds, dead animals. Like there are like feathers everywhere. There are like, you know, skins of like snakes and things that couldn't handle the poison, the toxins.
Who came
here
too far in.
Totally. Again,
you hear
like
again
another
all the croaking, and you're like, well, something's alive here. What's going on?
So there would be like legends about when you hear this much frog activity.
This much frog song.
Paranormal frog activity. When you hear like a certain like level of like frog song, or when you you see the dead animals on the floor and you hear the frogs will always persist. The frogs will survive. Again, it's nonstop frogs. Like there would be
non-stop
legends about
frogs.
These forests that
definitely. No, I think the local sentient people, whoever they are, would tell you like don't go into the toxic forest.
Yeah, totally.
The decaying forest.
Legends about this. This also reminds me real quick of the frogs going out.
Frogs going
situation,
out.
Which is we went to an improv show for
No, that's not what it came from.
Well, it didn't come to this, but this was like the fun story of it. Is we played a game of Quiplash and Piper said frogs going out as a prompt for the game.
Yeah.
And it was like a funny inside joke.
It was the best thing ever, because everyone is so inclined to do something like promiscuous or dirty.
Yeah, yeah,
and I just
like
went with the most innocent thing, which is like frogs going out. It was
We went to an improv show at like a local comedy theater, and they were like, we need like a prompt for the thing, and Piper shouts, frogs going out, you know, like frogs going out on the town or something, and they were like, frogs coming out? Sure.
Great.
So suddenly they were improvising a bunch of gay frogs.
It was amazing.
They were
all the
like Alex Jones like gay frogs.
Oh my god.
It was very, very funny. One of our favorite memories.
Anyway, I guess I would call those guys, if you want to reference this animal in your game, these would be frogs from the decaying forest.
It makes me think of one of my favorite Pokemon, Toxicroak, the poison fighting type frog.
Hey, is he the one who his tongue is a scarf?
No, that is...
that's dumb.
No,
that frog, that animal is dumb.
No. That's
a ninja frog.
Ninja toad, ninja frog. What is his name? I feel really embarrassed.
I don't know.
Yeah, no, Greninja is the frog. He like wraps his tongue around his neck like a scarf. He's like cool.
He appeared in the Pikachu, Detective Pikachu movie. So.
He appeared a lot. He was kind of like a flagship Pokemon for a while, because they have like in the show, they had the like Ash version of Greninja where he wears Ash's hat, or he has like a different like physical appearance or something like that.
I
think Greninja is really cool.
And maybe come at me, Pokemon fans, if you have a justification for this, but I feel like a lot of times Pokemon, unlike what we're trying to do here, where we're trying to justify why these animals exist, there isn't a reason justified in the universe of why these exist. Why would a Pokemon have a long tongue that wraps around its neck? Because to us as humans, it looks like a scarf. But to the animal, why would it do that?
An animal wouldn't need it. Yeah, okay. Look, here's the thing. So I'm going to give a shout out actually to another friend of the show, adjacent podcast, Beg to Differ.
Okay.
Maisie and John have an awesome podcast where they just talk about unpopular opinions. I was on their podcast a few months ago talking about unpopular opinions, and basically my unpopular opinion on their episode was a Pokemon themed episode, and I basically thought, I don't think that the new Pokemon are any more dumb than the original ones, right? Like, I don't think having a ninja frog with a tongue for a scarf is any more stupid than having a Pokemon that's made of garbage, or having a Pokemon like Volt Orb that's just a circle. It's of an electric orb. Like, I don't know. I think I love Pokemon. I am like ride or die for every generation of Pokemon. I'm a huge Pokemon apologist. The point I'm trying to make is Pokemon are good and you should calm down. Greninja's really cool.
It's silly, but why don't you generate yourself a biome so you can make another animal?
I did generate a biome actually already. I closed it down because I was looking up Greninja actually. It was estuary. Okay. So where a water formation where salt and fresh water meet. So you see all kinds of interesting, unique kind of interactions between the creatures here. It actually makes me think of, I was in Mexico with my family a few years ago, and we went to this really cool resort called Xel-Há, where we basically, we took a truck up like a mile or two up this river that goes out into the Caribbean Sea, and we put on like life jackets and snorkels, and we basically just like floated down the river like towards the sea, and the further out that we got, the more salinated the water became. So you started seeing this really like totally unique ecosystem of, you know, there were freshwater fish and saltwater fish that had both kind of adapted in this sort of weird wiggle room of they don't need only saltwater, they don't need only freshwater. It's like a totally unique environment for them. It was a really, really cool experience. I got to just swim around and like dive down, and there was like kind of corally type areas there, and
that's
they
so
were
cool.
Like really, really beautiful tropical looking fish, and it was a very, very fun experience.
Well, I have the perfect word for you then.
What is the word, Piper?
Your word is utopian.
Ooh.
Which works so well with a biome that is the
it's
nexus,
like the marriage between
of
two
saltwater
things.
And
yeah.
Freshwater. So okay. Describe for me an animal that would come from this utopian mix of two different worlds.
So I love the idea that,
and try to make it not a fish because you just made a fish.
Well, okay, fine. I do love
saying.
A good fish. But we haven't. Well, I guess I did.
You could have
just make a fish,
an otter or a bird.
All right. So the thing that I'm getting from this right away, like the sort of utopic aspect of this, I see a creature that has adapted to two different environments, right? And that it can thrive in both environments. It finds itself perfectly at home in either place. And maybe that's kind of the main thing of this creature, is that it learned to adapt very, very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So where other creatures, you know, take generations to develop new evolutionary traits to, you know, breathe in toxic fumes or to you know, breathe salt water versus fresh water or whatever. I think this would be a creature that can find itself perfectly at home in any environment in a very short span of time.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe kind of like a shape-changing type creature. Or,
it's like a Ditto from Pokemon.
Totally. Exactly.
A little gum guy.
I like the idea of, maybe it is like a little otter or something, or a little like a bird. I think like a bird. We haven't done a bird-like creature, nothing close to a bird. The idea of like a marine bird, like a pelican or like a cormorant or something like that can very, very quickly adapt to eating food in any environment. It can breathe underwater in salt or fresh water. Maybe it can
like a adapt. Bird with gills.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
A
maybe that's
of
kind
sky
of a thing.
And the sea.
Yeah.
Oh, it can fly, like, but it can that. Also swim and live underwater if it wanted to.
Exactly.
Cool.
It
describe what this looks like, please.
So I think it's sort of like the bird equivalent of, I talked about sort of like a lungfish last episode, right? But like whatever the bird equivalent of that is, that like it has wings, but it has wings in the same way that kind of like a bat has wings, where it's got like hand kind of claws on the end of them. It's maybe a little more leathery. So it's suited for a terrestrial environment. And I think, again, kind of to like the Pokemon sort of aspect of it, something that I think that's been really, really cool in the last few generations of Pokemon is they have different versions of existing Pokemon that are based on a particular region.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe the area where these animals are born into can influence the form that it kind of takes on. So if it's a, maybe that's like somehow temperature based, right? So if the parent bird lays an egg and it lays an egg in an area that's, it's always really, really hot, it will come out of the egg adapted to that, like a tropical environment. Or if it lays an egg in an area that's kind of cold, it will come out adapted to kind of a cold environment. Mm-hmm. So like in the same way as we have like Alolan Raichu and like Galar, Weezing or whatever, there's Pokemon that exist in different regions that have slightly different types or different adaptations. I like the idea of this is an animal maybe that can exist in like any biome. It's the most adaptable animal. So if you go to like a tundra, you will see this animal. If you go to a tropical like archipelago, you'll see this animal. If you go to a rainforest, you'll see this animal. But it can just adapt to any situation.
Right.
So I know I said kind of like bird-like at first, mm-hmm. but I think maybe something that's more interesting is like... What is the most adaptable animal you can think of in reality, right? An insect. Okay, cool.
Yeah. So an insect can be found in a million different places.
Totally. There are like ants in every different biome. So maybe it's like a giant like beetle or something. Maybe it's like a dung beetle or like a stag beetle. A stag beetle's way cooler. So yeah. like a big like rhino
dung
beetle
out of it.
With like a cool like horn, right? But the horn takes on a different shape based on where it is. Maybe the horn is like the tool that this beast has.
And some beetles can fly. So yeah. If it's like a giant beetle with wings, it could also like swim and burrow underwater.
Totally.
But it could also take flight and fly into the sky if it needed to.
And maybe if it's like again, we're just designing a Pokemon here basically, but like, you know, if it's this beetle, when it exists in like a snowy area, the horn is like a shovel shape, so it can dig
that makes
through
sense.
The snow.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, that's
and
really
if it's
cool.
Like in the sky, it would sort of be act as like a windbreaker as it
totally.
Flies.
So
and
it's
if
more
it was,
aerodynamic.
And if it was
water.
Swimming, it would part the water or the yeah. muck that it's burrowing through.
Absolutely.
Very cool.
It's in the water, it's more like a narwhal. It's just like a pointed horn. In the sky, it probably has like a fan out at the front, so it's like a airfoil basically.
Very cool.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of really, really cool, very simple changes you could make to this animal that could adapt it to any different environment. That's
awesome.
Really, really fun.
Okay.
To me. Oh, I love this one.
I like that too. Okay, cool. Are we doing one more each?
Let's do one more each. Why not? Why
okay,
not? Okay.
Just for fun.
Do you want another? Well, this has all been really fun, Piper. Every one of these has been for fun.
To be totally honest. It's been great.
I'm giving you your next environment, which is Piper.
Yes.
Mountains. We haven't done mountains, have we?
Nope.
I don't think so. Yeah. Mountains. Mountains for you, Piper. And what is your prompt?
Oh, boy. None of these words are working. Okay. I'm going to land with this one. I got mushy
cool.
mountains. So that leads me to imply these are mountains made of like mud. And I think they're constantly
okay.
like
mudslides all the time.
Well, they're like constantly shifting and changing. So they are if you stand at the base of these mushy mountains and you look up, and they do look quite imposing with how tall they are. But if you were to like walk away and make camp and come back the next day, the mountain range would look entirely different.
Well, I kind of like that.
Because it's kind of like constantly like sliding around and like making different shapes. And I guess it would just be because maybe there's like a huge amount of like moisture and earth on top of these tectonic plates that are like constantly shoving this like mud into different like mountainous formations.
Interesting.
So I guess the first thing that comes to mind as an animal who lives in the mountains would be an ibex, which is
big antelope type creature.
It's akin to a bighorn sheep.
Yeah.
They have large curling antlers and a very adept little hooves for like scaling almost impossible cliff sides. So maybe there is a mammal-like creature who can exist on the constantly shifting mushy mountain that they live on.
It's like a mountain goat, but instead of tiny little hooves, it wears snowshoes.
Well, okay.
It's like slushy snowshoes.
So I don't want to just make another oil skipper like I did
yeah.
with the hare.
Yeah, we
and
can't
so,
do big feet again. That's played out.
Honestly, okay, what I'm picturing is like, what if there was like an ibex, but it had kind of like how a sugar glider between its arms has these like webs.
Ooh, like a flying deer.
Exactly. But I also think instead of like hooves, it needs to have these creepy little like hook-like claws so it can like hook into the mountainside.
I like that.
And
so
I think
it's like half bat, half deer.
Yes, half bat, half goat. With these huge horns that spiral off of it. Ooh, a spooky goat bat. Okay. And so I think what they do is they cling to the mountainside, because I think when the mud is, like, transitioning, during noon or, like, when the sun is highest in the sky, parts of these, like, mud mountains would solidify and become kind of more harder. And that's where the these, like, kind of gliding goats sort of, like, accumulate. Mm. And they would hook their talons into this harder kind of crust that forms the mud that dries in the sun, and these they would like sit there and but what would they eat? I feel
maybe they can like the land, siphon minerals out of the mud or something like that.
I think they do a lot of licking. Yeah. They lick the mud constantly, but I think there's also maybe like a lot of insects that like fly around up here. Maybe they have freaky like frog tongues that shoot out.
So the beetle creature that I created would exist in this biome, certainly. Like
your beetle is enormous. I don't think these guys could shoot out a tongue and grab a giant beetle the same size as them.
Adapt to different sizes. Maybe they're not humongous in every biome. Maybe in some biomes they have to be really small, you know?
Maybe.
We've talked about gigantism and minimalism twice on this episode already.
I think a lot of gliding creatures are very good at, like, silently moving through the air, maybe using, like, echolocation to, like bats do to, like, get insects.
Okay, I love a flying echolocating goat.
Right? No, so I think they have, like, how goats normally have those freaky pupils that are, like, sideways rectangles.
Yeah.
These goats, I think their eyes are way larger than normal.
Okay, they're like an owl's eyes or something.
Yes, and they have these, like, I don't want to necessarily give them bat ears because my last rabbit creatures had really big ears, but maybe they do just have like huge disc-like ears on the sides of their heads.
It's hard to create lot of things all at once.
Well, yes. So I think these, they look kind of like goats, but they have like bat-like wings, like webbing between their top legs and their bottom legs, and they hook onto the sides of these kind of like encrusted, like molten rock sides, and what they do is their heads can turn in like 180 degrees like an owl can.
This is horrifying.
It's super horrifying.
This is awful.
They listen for the insects that are flying around, or maybe even the birds.
Cool.
And they can, like, if they climb high enough during the day, they can then let go and project themselves off of these sides and kind of sail down and catch them in their teeth.
I like that.
Or like shoot out their if I wanted to make them even creepier, which I'm going to, I think their mouths are sort of like how the predator has these jaws that can open up like a big web, so their mouths can
so they can like catch a large
their mouth opens up like a huge like net, like, and they can like kind of try and like engulf, like how like a these AKA
this is gross.
The freakiest animal you can imagine.
It's sort of like a weird flying like chupacabra type. This is the most horrifying thing I can picture.
I'm so proud of this animal, honestly. I really it.
This is good for like a spooky like eldritch horror, like Cthulhu type setting, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Like you want like a very terrifying just
because
normal animal that exists
they wouldn't be a threat to any sort of like humanoid person, so if you're like D&D party was walking through these mountains,
really desperate,
exactly, you might see them clinging to the cliffside and they would look at you and they would make sort of like a bleeding sound, but their jaws would open like a predator's mouth would, like this kind of web, and they'd be like and you'd be like, Jesus Christ, let's keep walking. Like, don't mess with those things.
And there would probably be a lot of like legends because these creatures are so horrifying. People would probably think that they're like evil creatures spawned by the devil, but really they're just, they're not even necessarily predators. They're, you know, they're a predator in the same way as like a a robin is a predator for eating worms. Or
right.
Whatever.
Well, they eat insects and small birds, and they lick the mountainside. And I can't imagine a predator. I think they are. I don't think they have a predator that pursues them. I think their most common like cause of death is that the mountain shifts and they get sucked into the mud and they die.
Oh, okay.
So it's their environment that kills them.
Ever changing mountainscape here.
Right.
Interesting.
So I think maybe what your party would have to be worried about is if you found the like oldest of their kind, like the great bull, gliding goat.
Its ram horns curl 1,000 times.
Right.
Like a little curly
fry. It would be like the size of a dragon. Like maybe it had lived so long that it got so big.
Yeah.
And it's big enough that it can fly down and like gobble you up.
Its old gray hair and its blind glassy eyes.
Yeah. So that's my creature. I want to call them, I guess, the mountain gliders.
I like that. I wrote down the owl-eyed goat gliders.
That sounds cool.
That's a good one too. Yeah. There's a lot of good names for
these. Very proud of this freak creation.
Cool. So that's another good one.
One last one for you, right?
Yeah, one more for me.
Okay.
I've got my
What's your
biome here. My biome is desert.
Okay.
And my word is...
Your word is... Oh my god, teeny tiny came up. I'm going to give you the teeny tiny desert. That word literally came up in the prompt
One, I like that teeny tiny is considered to be one word.
One word, it's a hyphen word.
That's really cute.
Teeny tiny desert. What lives in a teeny tiny desert?
Like island minimalism, right? Maybe it is like a desert island that the creature who
lives here...
We've
already talked about islands, though. I challenge you to make it a teeny tiny desert that exists like on a mainland somewhere.
Okay,
do that.
So maybe it's a... I guess the direction I was kind of going with that is that it's just... It was a desert that was like separated off by tectonic movement or something, and so it maintained its biome status as a desert, but it drifted off to sea, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the creatures that lived on it became super small because there's very little resources available to them. I think we can still go in this in a similar direction to this. What I kind of want to do is just take an existing animal and make it very, very small because it had to adapt to a desert. You know, maybe it's like a microscopic little gecko or something like that.
That'd be cute.
Yeah,
see, what I want to challenge, instead of just taking an animal that we know and making it smaller, because we've kind of already done that, is like, what if there was a biome that was really, really small and it was like like sandwiched in between two other very extreme biomes?
And that makes sense because I guess we did say at the top that this modifier is for the biome, not for the creature. So
exactly.
It does have to be the teeny tiniest desert.
It's a very small desert.
Yeah.
It's like you could like walk across it in like 5 minutes.
Yeah, totally.
And you're like, well, that was weird. Why is this desert here?
So here, maybe this is a thing. Maybe it's a desert that's stuck between like a tundra and a rainforest or two like weird other biomes. But the only hunting ground this animal has is this desert.
Cool.
All of like the food that it gets, it has to go into this desert every day to survive and to hunt and to feed.
So
right?
It's from another biome, but it hunts in your biome.
In a teeny tiny desert, yes.
Cool, cute. I like
that. So, like, what type of animal could survive in a rainforest and in a tundra, but eats in a desert?
So what that makes me think of is something that, like, when it lives in a rainforest, it, like, has the ability to, like, suck up all this moisture and absorb all this moisture for them when it goes into the desert to hunt. It has that so it can survive.
So, okay, here's what I think. So when I think of moisture, I think of like mold and like mushrooms and things.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe this is a creature that allows, like how like a sloth has fungus that grows on its back.
Yeah.
Maybe this is a creature that allows like mushrooms and fungus and things to grow on it for some type of symbiotic purpose. It can eat these mushrooms or the mushrooms that grow on its back attract. Oh, maybe this is it. So it spends its days in the rainforest, right?
Mm-hmm.
And during the morning, so during the day, like these mushrooms like grow on its back. And then like midway through the day, it goes into the desert. These mushrooms attract all kinds of bugs that it then eats. And then at night, it goes into the tundra, so the cold kills the mushrooms before the mushrooms sap too much energy from it.
Very interesting.
So, like, every day, it's like a new cycle, right?
Nice.
So, this must... I view this as some kind of like a hairy like mammalian animal, maybe like a weird kind of sloth like dog creature or something.
I'm picturing sort of like a herd type creature.
Yeah,
that would just like meander through these different elements.
Totally.
And I think what you talked about the tundra, like
maybe
I
it's like a buffalo, like a jungle buffalo.
Right. Like at the end of the day, it hunkers down to like go to sleep, and that like the cold kills the things on its back, and then it can wake again and then go into
and
its new
start
biome.
The cycle anew. Yeah.
Very
so
interesting.
Sort of moves in this circular pattern every single day, and it's specifically adapted to this very, very particular place. It can only survive in this location where there is a jungle, a desert, and a tundra all in very close proximity.
What that makes me think of is something very sad, and it's the idea that someone would find this animal and take it away from those
three
specific things.
Totally, they'd take it to a zoo or something, and it would...
And the animal, like, they'd be trying to sell it in a market, and the animal would just be, like, making this wailing sound.
Yeah, they're like, why is this animal not doing well? Why is it so sad and unhealthy?
And they're like, it's in a cage. What do you want? Do you want to buy it? And then, but if you bought it and it didn't return to its environment, it would die, like, in the next, like, few, like, days or something.
Oh, that's really sad.
It's very sad. I'm sorry, but I think it's important to consider those things.
I like that. I like that it's just like it's basically a big like bison that has to exist in this very specific location, and there would be like a lack of understanding that humanity or whatever controlling civilization in your world has about this creature.
But, unless maybe there is a like a local group of people, a civilization who have observed this animal throughout their evolution.
I like that.
I like the idea that maybe when the bison-like creature comes to the tundra zone to kind of nestle down and sleep, they have learned that they can come in and harvest the mushrooms from its back.
Oh, I like that.
And they can take that.
And they have like a very short window before the mushrooms die from the cold, but after the kind of rowdy, dangerous animal goes to sleep in the snow.
Right. Yeah. And that would be a sort of like interesting form of domestication.
Yeah.
Because then the animal wakes up, it's unburdened by the weight upon it, and it can meander onto its other environment.
So this definitely creates a really interesting sort of cultural and ecological interaction between I like this, that we've created an animal that sort of facilitates an interesting kind of human culture around it, that you know you have like people who herd reindeer in Siberia and they kind of survive off of the herding of this type of animal, you know, that there's a group of druids or rangers or some, you know, some kind of classification of survivalists that subsist off of the mushrooms or the fungus that they harvest off of this animal.
I think
and
it
there's
would
a
be...
very, very specific relationship between the two of them that couldn't exist anywhere else.
Yes. And I think there has to be, they must be dedicated to encouraging these animals to return on a regular basis. And
absolutely.
So I think what they do is they cultivate the grasses that the bison come to feed on so they continue to come back.
Oh, so they kind of entice them to move in certain directions.
And perhaps, I mean, with the sort of like hunter-gatherer part of a society, maybe they also, they make sure to regularly hunt the predators in those areas so they don't feed on the bison, so the bison can continue to return.
So that sort of would inform the technological progression of this society as well. Like they would evolve to create tools that would allow them to more effectively hunt a very specific type of creature.
Right.
To protect this herd that they have.
I like that.
But
I
they
like
can't
that a lot.
Really, they have to be free range. They can't really like rein them in because they have to travel between these three different locations.
Well,
they're like the ultimate free range creature.
Seriously, I love that kind of the idea of that trust that you have, where if a foreigner came in and they saw your society, they'd be like, where are your animals going?
Yeah.
And you would say, they're off to these different lands, but they will return because we always have grass for them and we keep the predators away.
I like that a lot.
It's a trust that we have with these animals. And to someone else who's used to keeping like fences around their creatures, they think, this is crazy. Like, what are you doing?
I also really like how hyper-specific this adaptation is, right? It reminds me of like another creature that I was going to talk about at the top that I totally forgot was the pistol shrimp, right? Like, I love a creature that has...
A real life animal.
Yeah, a real life animal that has such a specific evolutionary adaptation that it cracks its knuckles so hard that it makes a gunshot level.
Boom.
Yeah, like a little sonic boom or whatever. Yeah. Like that's so specific, right? Like no other creature has any adaptation that's even remotely similar to that. That this is kind of a similar example of that, that this would be an animal that it can only exist in a very, very specific environment, situation, like kind of ecological like cycle. I don't know. That's really, really fun.
Well, if you wanted to tell another sad story, that might be a good start for a quest.
Stop telling sad stories.
I'm just saying is that these people, because the bison always return because they make the land habitable for them, and they say, you have these grasses, we've taking care of the predators, you will return to us. But if the bison were coming back in fewer and fewer numbers, it'd be this mystery and saying,
of course,
someone must be hunting them in one of the other
help
zones.
Help us track down the hunters of these creatures, or help
someone,
us protect them. Yeah.
Exactly. Someone new came to this area and they've been hunting them either in the rainforest or the desert. And so there are fewer and fewer of them returning. And so you have to
like
return
that.
This balance.
I like that a lot.
That'd be a really fun, like, nature-based quest.
There are a lot of really cool directions you can go with all these. Ooh, I really like this. I think is my most favorite creation this episode, just because of the necessity of sort of a human culture that has to exist.
I like that.
Adjacent to
a sentient culture.
Yeah, a sentient.
Doesn't have to
of
be
course,
human.
Human, elf, orc, whatever. Like,
yeah.
I kind of like the idea of like a steppes traveling, like a Mongolian type orc culture. They're like nomadic. They would follow these creatures around. They're really connected to the earth. They have sort of a druidic tradition. I think that's really, really neat.
Very cool.
I would love to hear from our listeners what types of you know, races or cultures you think would be especially adapted to living in symbiosis with this particular animal. I think that would be really, really fun to hear from you guys. So definitely please reach out to us and let us know what you think about that.
Yeah.
I think on that note, this is kind of a good time to move into the next segment of the show, mm-hmm. into the rec room, where we recommend some fun sources of inspiration and resources for you guys to help kind of create things in your worlds that are not of our creation, that are of other people's creations.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I actually thought of one while we were talking, but you had one that we agreed upon beforehand.
Yes,
so
I have a
go
really
ahead,
cool
and I'm going to
one.
Add one after.
So I've got a really awesome one from a listener and collaborator of ours, Cameron Day. That is Cameron Day of Daylight Publications. That's his Twitter here is at DaylightPub1066. At Twitter. He created this really, really awesome supplement. I'm going to pronounce this horribly. It's called the Garadrug. It's basically, it's a D&D class that's based on Celtic folklore. It's a specific area of Celtic folklore called like tree divination or something like that. And the idea is basically, it's kind of like a druid adjacent class or like a ranger adjacent class where you are called by like a mystical grove and you make a pact with them. So it's sort of like a mix between, I sort of view this as a mix between like a warlock and a druid, which I think is really, really cool.
Yeah.
You sort of make an agreement to protect this forest. And when you do that, you can make a pact with a certain type of tree. So there's like the pact of birch and the pact of oak, and whatever pact you make determines the progression path that you set out on. So what I think is most unique about this class is that you can play sort of like a melee version of this class. You can play a healing version of this class. You can play a, you know, like an offensive spell casting version of this class. So theoretically, you could have a whole party consisting of just this class and no one member of the party would play the same way, mm-hmm. which I think is really, really neat. It's an incredibly versatile and incredibly well-researched supplement. I really, really liked everything that I saw of this. Cameron sent us kind of a preview copy of this, and it's actually a part of a bigger supplement that he had put together called From Root and Twig, which is like, I think he describes it on his site as a timber themed supplement for D&D with a bunch of different subclasses and you know, monsters and all kinds of cool stuff in here. I think
I
there's
like
a
that.
There's so much really, really interesting. It's like about the connection to the forest, and I think it makes a lot of sense to talk about this after doing an episode of talking about the animals and the ecology of certain biomes and locations. This is a class that is based on a location, a natural location specifically. It's really, really fun.
Well, my rec room was actually since we are creating different animals in this episode, I was thinking about this actually, Sam, when you started talking about the Irish elk, and it made me think of the original novel Bambi that the Disney animated movie was inspired by. So I would suggest that people, if you want to come up with cool creatures, you should definitely check out some animal fantasy in classic literature, because the novelization of Bambi, as surprising as it may seem, is actually quite insightful, and it really delves into the like looking through the lens of like a non-human understanding of things.
Totally.
And it's just such a cool way to kind of refresh your imagination and your approach to understanding certain elements of things.
Yeah.
There's an incredible scene in the novel in which Bambi, the white-tailed deer, is walking through the forest with his mother, and a herd of elk go walking by. But the way that he describes it in the scene is that it seems as if these beings who were made of trees because of their great antlers, they come walking like ghosts through the shadows. His mother goes stock still, and he starts bleeding out of fear. And he's just like making these noises, and he can't control himself. And once they pass, he like finally catches his breath, and he asks her, he's like, "What was that? Who were they? They looked like us, but they were so much bigger and so much grander." And she just says, she's like, "Those were the kings of the forest, and we don't talk about them. Like, we can't understand them. They're so much above us."
I love that. And I think that really touches on kind of the primal, like elemental sort of energy that we, you know, really said was one of the things I find most interesting about the idea of megafauna, like the Irish elk.
Yes.
And I also think that's a really good exercise in, I think a really valuable thing in Dungeons and Dragons is to consider as many possible perspectives as possible, right?
Yes.
Like, we've talked about this on the Twitter before, that I think a really valuable thing for DMs is to play with new players or players mm-hmm. who are from other systems or who are unfamiliar with Dungeons and Dragons, because you'll
have perspectives.
Yeah, the more ideas and the more kind of backgrounds and the more diversity you introduce into your games, the more you will have fun, new, interesting experiences. And also the more it will help you to prepare for, you know, when your players do things that are unexpected. If you consider all of the different approaches to solving a problem or all of the different approaches to telling a story, it will help you to tell more interesting stories and will help you to adapt to unexpected changes in sort of the status quo that your players may introduce into your stories. So
yeah,
that's definitely a really valuable thing. If you look at this type of thing from that lens, that's tremendous.
So it'll just give you a fresh perspective.
Yeah, wonderful.
Cool.
So those are two great Rec Room recommendations from us here. And again, just to give the contact information for Cameron Day, that's at DaylightPub1066 on Twitter, or DaylightPublications.Weebly.com.
Weebly.
A website where you can see all of his Professor Schneebly. You can see all of Cameron's releases on his website there. He's also on DM's Guild and I think DriveThruRPG. You can find his stuff anywhere. We'll have links to all of that. But if you wanted to reach out to us with any of your ideas, Piper, where could our listeners find us online?
You can find us on Twitter. We are at WorldForgePod on Twitter. You can tweet us any of your suggestions. If you want us to spend an entire episode just kind of brainstorming something for you that you've been struggling with, give us a topic, give us a theme, and we will muddle through it for you on your behalf.
We would love that.
It'd be great. Also, feel free to send us an email at worldforgepod@gmail.com. You can find us streaming anywhere. Please recommend to your friends and family.
Yes, and consider leaving us a review if you want to support the show. We don't have a Patreon or a coffee or anything like that. We don't really do any of this for money yet. But if you really want to do something to support the show, a totally free way to do that would be to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or on Stitcher or on whatever podcasting platform you use. That goes so far towards getting our podcast in front of the ears of new listeners. And it means so much to us. It just is always really exciting every time we get a new review. It's so much fun. That's really about it, I think, for this week.
Sam, we have something exciting to look forward to next week, though, don't we?
We do have something really exciting next week. So next week, we will actually be joined by a very exciting guest, Jason Tondreau, one of the developers of the Starfinder role-playing game here.
It's gonna be cool.
Lucky enough to be given some very, very interesting supplements for Starfinder. We're in the process of putting together a Starfinder game coming up really soon, and I think he's going to have some really, really interesting insight into kind of the world building and storytelling aspect of that game. So definitely come back next week to hear that. That's going to be a really, really special episode. We're really excited about it.
That'll be great.
Yeah. So.
And until then, make sure your brain is thinking of new ideas every single day.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Don't let your brain stop thinking of things.
Yeah.
If it does, you'll die.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what happens.
You're like a shark, a creative shark. You must keep swimming.
Yeah, so keep swimming. Listeners, keep thinking, keep swimming. Stay up, stay woke, stay good, stay happy. I don't know. Bye.
Bye.